prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Addisk, will be here for the second and third segment of the program today. We have James Corbett. He's back from the Corbett Report. Just had a little baby I'm sure he'll talk about here shortly, but and it's good to have James returning to the program. But first, let's get to the market report for Thursday, May 19th, 2016. Well, gold prices ended a little bit lower today. There was some follow-through from selling from yesterday's FOMC minutes that were released from their April meeting. Prices were off the low, so that is a good thing. We have gold down currently in the New York spot, down $360 at $1,255.40. Silver is still down $43 at $16.55. Platinum is down 16 at 1,015, and palladium is down 14 at $562. The USDX today was higher, also from that report, 95.31. Crude oil is down 0.02 at 48.17. Paper markets today, the Dow down 91 points. 17,434. The NASDAQ is down 26 at 4712. The S&P was down 7 at 2039. 10-year yield down 0.04 at 1.84%. The euro continues to drop, of course, with the dollar getting stronger, 1.112, down 0.17. And most of the foreign markets were down overnight on the news of the FOMC. And so, again, we have the dollar hit a four-week high, a little bit of pressure on oil. And, again, we mentioned this yesterday, the minutes from the FOMC gave the impression that rates could rise in June if economic growth continues. And, again, that's all debatable if you believe there. Or any government numbers, but I don't think the Fed's really makes their decisions on economic data. Yellen claims that she does. It's all about the data, but maybe it's really based on Wall Street data and not economic. And I think as long as you see the markets at these current levels, you might see another quarter point rise. But if markets are lower, than today. There's no way she'll risk Wall Street's numbers, not in June. And even if we look back to the Fed's increase in December, a quarter point, gold is still up 20%. It fell back this week, so we're looking at about 18%, but gold is still up. So all of those who think that gold is going to do poorly in a rising rate market, no, you might have initial knee-jerk reactions with a strength in the dollar, but hey, when census come back and everyone sees how everything is so screwed up, And how far can she really raise them? This country has to borrow in order to pay the interest on the debt now. So how in the world is she ever going to raise, rates anything significantly? We do have a special today, 1/10 ounce American Gold Eagle, 20 Silver Eagles, keeping it simple today. And the price on that is $555, and that does include your shipping and insurance. 1/10 ounce American Gold Eagle, 21-ounce American Silver Eagles. Those are dated 2016. They're brand new and include shipping and insurance for $555. The U.S. Mint has sold 2.9 million Silver Eagles this month for the month of May. And at that pace, it's on schedule to repeat a 4 million Silver Eagle month. We do have a three-day weekend coming up, but it's still another incredible month for American Silver Eagles, 1 ounce American Silver Eagles. So again, we're on the course for 4 million Silver Eagle month. Let's talk a little bit about health care, the affordable health care. You know, everyone knows that the prices are rising. Everybody complains about this. I've complained. My rates keep going up. This is my pet peeve because just as soon as the Affordable Health Care Act came into effect, I was canceled for absolutely no reason other they didn't comply any longer to the affordable health care, not me, but the insurance company. I believe a lot of this affordable health care and the push through that it was in order to pay these health insurance companies subsidies to keep them floating. They do get about a 10% from government subsidy since Obamacare came into effect. But that was just for the first couple of years, and that is about to cease here in the very near future. But here I came across these numbers. It's mainly about New York, but just to show you the amount of increases that these health insurers are asking, 17% for 2017. And New York just isn't the only one. There's a list of states where insurers are seeking huge increases in premiums under the program. New York's health insurers are seeking to raise that amount that customers pay. On average, is 17%. Florida insurers are looking for another 17% more. Washington State, 13.5%. I mean, these premium increases are getting crazy. Who in the heck can afford a 17% increase on their health insurance? And these numbers are low. You have insurers like United Health Group, they pulled out of the markets. Last year, insurers in New York State requested a 10% rate increase. Now it's 70%. So in 2 years, they're asking for a 27% increase. Care Connect, owned by the Northwell Health Insurance System on Long Island, 29% on average. Oscar Insurance Corp, a closely held startup that lost about $105 million last year, they're looking for 18% increase. United Health was seeking to boost New York premiums by 45%. I mean, these are incredible numbers. Who in the heck can afford that? Although you have folks, those who get it for basically nothing, they pay $1.50 for it. Their premiums aren't going to increase, But I mean, this program really was designed to fail, and that's exactly what is happening. So what did you expect? I just thought those percentages were just incredible, and I wanted to share them with you. And I'm sure those of you who have health care, it's certainly increasing to those percentages. Sports Authority, we're going to change the topic now, the Sports Authority. It was a huge sporting goods chain. They filed bankruptcy protection in March. First, they were only going to close about 150 stores. Now, they're looking at 450 stores. They're going to close them all. They couldn't find a buyer. They couldn't get any additional loans. So they're just closing the doors on all of them. 450 stores. As I mentioned before, they were going to close 140. And the flagship sports store is in Denver, Colorado. And they've been having a liquidation sale for weeks. There's another factory that is soon to close. Delta Apparel. It's a textile facility. And they're looking to let, 159 workers. Doesn't seem like a lot, but to those 159 workers, it is. It's significant. The company is going to move production. I'll give you several guesses to a plant in Honduras, and they might outsource additional fabric in Mexico. Delta said in a recent Worker Adjustment and Retaining Notification Act, this is all under federal law, these companies have to file these notices when they make these layoffs and close the plants and change ownership. It all comes under the NAFTA, and we'll talk about that in just a little bit, but the plant is about 38 miles northwest of Charlotte. They're going to start closing July 9th, and they said that they've had the past several years, they've just had weak economic conditions and have had a significant impact on the entire apparel industry. They also said that, and again, they have to file these notices with NAFTA. It's a petition with the U.S. Labor Department. They file this on behalf of the employees that are losing their jobs, and this is for potential benefits. So if the politicians thought that NAFTA would be good for the United States when they passed it back in the 90s, then why would they also pass to where companies have to file this petition so that they could extend benefits to help workers with training, help them with job search, and actually give them an allowance after the unemployment benefits are exhausted. So if NAFTA was so great in the 90s, then why would they have to do any sort of extension of benefits? And again, the politicians knew exactly what these trade agreements would do to the manufacturing in this country. And they knew that people would need help to be retrained and extend benefits after their unemployment benefits were exhausted. So they knew exactly what was going to happen. The Carolinas were once the heart of the U.S. textile industry. But since the late 1990s, thousands of jobs have been lost. Of course, when emerging markets that can offer cheaper materials and labor joined the game. The Carolinas textile jobs have gone to China. They've gone to Brazil and Vietnam and other places. Well, now we can add Honduras to the list. So again, another sign of the times. And I still find it difficult, even with tariffs. I think a lot of, you know, we're just not sure. Yesterday I saw where Marshalls, TJ Maxx, they were actually looking to increase a lot of their retail stores across the country. They're pretty much discount stores. I'm not sure you would be discounted the same as Walmart. They might be a next step up from Walmart, but pretty much in the same area. And again, it's another, if your discount stores can make it, but we know Walmart has had major problems. They're not doing as well as they used to. So it's hard for me to believe that Marshall's and TJ Maxx will be able to increase their stores significantly across this country. But then again, was this report about increasing the stores just an image building report? You know, they just release these reports, these news reports, say, hey, we're going to do great things. We're opening up a lot of stores, buy our stuff. And it's just image building. So when we talk about maybe with tariff building, you know, placing tariffs on products, trying to bring back manufacturing to this country, I'm positive. I'm hoping it can happen. I'm hoping something can be done. It might be just a little more difficult than it's one of those easier said than done. But we'll see. We're just about out of time. 20 minutes goes fast. And I just wanted to end the segment of the program today. It's just one of these articles that it doesn't really mean anything. And I know you're asking, then why are you even talking about it? But it's interesting. And it does sort of fit into the overall economies of the world. Times are a-changing. This is one of the areas of business that usually does well both in good times and bad times. This article talks about maybe in bad times this business is not doing so well. And the article is people aren't drinking as much as they used to. Global sales of alcohol fell in 2015 for the first time since market research has been keeping records. Now, what I found interesting is sales in dollar terms, they rose by 2% inflation in 2015, but the overall volume of consumption dropped by 0.7. So, I mean, are the people still drinking just as much as they did? They're just getting less booze. Their purchasing power has decreased due to inflation. They're spending just as much or more, just not getting the same amount of booze. So I'm not so sure that is really, how they can define the cutback. But also, what you're seeing is the biggest declines are coming in economies that are having major difficulties. China, which I didn't realize, they were the biggest consumers on the globe, saw consumption drop by 3.5%. And, of course, we all know what their economy has done the past year. Consumption in Brazil and Eastern Europe fell by 2.5% and 4.9% respectively. We know Brazil is facing a severe economic slump. They certainly have had their problems with their political situations and over corruption. Russia and Ukraine are also seeing their consumption also drop. And so I just thought it was interesting to see how the different areas are affected by bad economies. And I want to remind you listeners again of our special today for $555, a 1/10 ounce American Gold Eagle, 20 Silver Eagles, includes all your shipping and insurance costs for $555. Give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Alfred and James will be here right after we head out of the first break of the program.
financial obligations or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs' emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at the 3Ws dot thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Our guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report. James has been missing. He's been playing hooky for a couple of weeks. Any news to report, James?
Well, there's a new baby in the household.
Uh-huh.
She might be making an appearance. You never know.
Uh-huh. Little girl, right?
Yes, that's right. A little girl. Happy, healthy little girl, 6 pounds, 7 ounces, doing well.
Good. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I just want to point out to you, that's your second child, right?
That's right. Yeah, we have a 3-year-old son and now a newborn daughter.
Well, just want to remind you and your wife, Japan is having a little demographic problem, and it's not up to you two to solve that problem
all
by yourself.
We're doing our part.
I see that you're doing your part, and that's a good thing. That's a wonderful thing. You didn't send me a cigar.
Is that how it works? Oh.
Well, I don't know. I was wondering, in Japan, do they hand out cigars when they have a baby? And if they do, are the cigars made out of tobacco or seaweed?
I'll have to try a seaweed cigar sometime and let you know. I'll get one next time I'm in Texas. I don't even know.
Well, I don't smoke anyway, so it would be. It's just a
there
gist that would all. I've got, speaking of demographics, there's something from Business Insider, and it says we're about to see a mind-blowing demographic shift unprecedented in human history. The world is about to see a mind-blowing demographic situation that will be the first in human history. There are about to be more elderly people than young children. Within a few years, just before 2020, adults aged 65 and over will begin to outnumber children under the age of 5 among the global population. This is according to a study by Bank of America Merrill Lynch team and based on a report from the U.S. Census Bureau. What do you think about that? And what are the consequences of a world where we have more people over 65 than we have people under 5 years old?
There are a lot of consequences to that, aren't there? And I guess the first order that is often framed in is the economic consequences, which are, I mean, pretty dire from the perspective of a system which has been engineered to rely on each new generation getting itself into debt, perpetuating the debt cycle and blowing up the bubble even further, getting mortgages and committing to the system in that way. And as you have fewer and fewer young people getting online and getting houses and all of that, you'll have less of that activity in the economy. And of course, you'll also have more and more retirees being supported by fewer and fewer actual workers, which becomes unsustainable at a certain point. So that is not to the good, but that is perhaps the consequences of the system that we've been living in, which has been predicated on this idea. There will always be a fresh new batch of children to come along and take up their place in the debt chain.
It's P.T. Barnum economics. There's one born every minute.
Keep them coming in the door. And as long as that doesn't ever stop, hey, you're fine. As long as you can grow forever, there will never be a problem. So that is, I mean, that in the long term is a problem. On the other hand, it's interesting to look at these types of numbers, which we've known for a number of years now are coming down the line. We've known that the population boom that of course we saw in the baby boom years is winding down. And the way that looks on the charts is, of course, the population continues to increase for some time, but it starts to slacken out and then eventually to drop. And that's what all the projections have shown. So the 1960s craze of the population bomb and all of that kind of hype has been proven to be the hype that it is. So it's interesting to see that taking place. And I guess in the longer term, what this also points towards is that growth curve of elderly versus young, even if we were getting more young children, would still be continuing to increase because people are living longer and will presumably be living longer and longer as we move out. And there are, of course, people like Ray Kurzweil and others who say that, you know, if you live the next 20 years or so, you'll be able to live forever because the life extension technology will keep improving and improving so that basically we'll be seeing the first generation of people who never have to die. I don't know if I believe that per se, but I certainly do think that we will be getting longer and longer life expectancies, which is going to change the dynamic somehow. I mean, our society is structured on people retiring at 65 and dying at 70, and that's not happening anymore.
Do you think it's a good thing if people with technology reaches a point where we can essentially live forever? Do you think that's a good thing?
I don't know if we can frame it as good or bad, because it's what we do with it, how we as a species really deal with that. And the way we're set up, as I say, I don't think we're set up societally, structurally, economically to be able to deal with that at the moment. I think it could be dealt with, but it would require a reordering of civilization. I mean, it would look nothing like what we know today, because if you could live, I mean, even, you know, a couple hundred years, let alone a couple thousand, think of what that would do to calculations about, okay, well, should I have children? When should I
have
children? How many children should I have? I mean, obviously that changes that dynamic completely. And, I mean, I suppose if you could literally live forever, then, well, why do I need replacements at all? I'll just be me for my entire life.
Do I dare have replacements?
Yeah.
If no one is going to die, if that were the truth of the matter, right now we love people in part because they are impermanent and they are mortal and they're going to die and they're going to pass on. But if people didn't pass on, if they didn't die, how long would it be before we got awfully sick of seeing more people? You know, we would be packing in tighter and tighter and more sardines in the can and more sardines in the can until people stand up and say, look, will somebody please get rid of all the rest of these idiots? I mean, I'm not sure that we can maintain a positive attitude toward our fellow men. That's hard enough to do in the first place. But if they're not going to die and get out of the way, all of a sudden it becomes, my God,
right.
I don't know.
But even that is kind of assuming that the baseline of the technological development we're at stays the same, which of course it won't. So who knows what type of technologies and possibilities we'll have in the future for not only colonizing parts of the Earth that we never would have imagined before, but perhaps colonizing other planets or asteroids or moons or whatever. I mean, yeah. I mean, when you really start to look at the science fiction-like possibilities that are becoming more and more kind of real possibilities, it requires a complete rethinking of what it even means to be human. And I don't know if we're ready for that, really.
That's true.
I mean, if we're on some sort of development level as a civilization, I think we're at the point where we better be ready for adulthood. Like it or not, it's coming.
Yeah, I understand. I've got another question. We haven't talked about Fukushima. You're, of course, talking to us from Japan. You're at the southern end of Japan, and Fukushima is more at the northern end, if I understand correctly. But just brief, it says North America will not be safe from Fukushima radiation if plant keeps leaking. Animals suddenly died on the West Coast after the 2011 disaster. Whole world noticed the strange phenomena. Fatally high levels of radioactive material entering the ocean. Serious pollution is ongoing. It's hard to get real information or reliable information on what's happening. Some people say there's a blackout on information. Some people, it's just business as usual. No big thing, nothing to report. Do you know anything about Fukushima that you think the average American needs to know but doesn't?
I think you're exactly right that it's hard to get good information out of this because there are people who profit from hyping it up to the point where, you know, everyone's going to die, you know, click on this and you'll find the answers, to the other side, which is everything's totally peachy keen, fine, you know, nothing to worry about, you know, go look at something else. And I think obviously reality is somewhere in the middle, but who is in the middle actually providing that reporting? And I'll give you and your listeners a tip on a source that I find quite valuable in all of this. It's a YouTube channel called Goddard's Journal, G-O-D-D-A-R-D-S Journal. And he does really well done video presentations. They're about 10 minutes long. They come out every couple months or so on all sorts of different aspects of Fukushima and radiation and what it really means, the scientific and health analysis of this from a really unbiased, from what I can tell, in a very unbiased perspective. He will look at the claims, the claims of, you know, everyone's dying, everything's dead, we're all going to die, and debunk those. But he will also look at the claims of there's no risk whatsoever from this type of radiation and debunk that. And he has lots of very good scientific sources that he uses. So I think it's a very good way of putting this into perspective. And he's had a few videos where he puts the radiation that is still continuing to leak into the ocean from Fukushima in perspective of even the background radiation that exists now from the open atmospheric testing that we had, you know, 50 years ago. And he shows, you know, what this means, what it looks like, how much it's affected things, whether that's measurable, how that's going to affect your health, and what it means for the people in Fukushima. And I think he's done some really good reporting on that. So that's one source that I would really encourage people to look at if they want to see this from outside of that hype versus everything's fine spectrum that we tend to see in the reporting.
It's Goddard Journal. Is that a YouTube channel?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I'll take a look myself. Hope the rest of you do the same. One of the things I'm curious about, what's happening to sea life? Given that Japan has a fabulous appetite for fish, it would have to show up, I assume it would have to show up in the markets if something, there are reports that the northern Pacific is dying. And I don't know if it's true or false, but it would show up in your marketplace. I assume it would. And is there a problem with the Japanese access to fish, to sea life?
There have, in the few years after Fukushima, there were times when fishing in the direct area of the bay there was off limits. And then there were times when they took that restriction off and there was fishing again, and then they put it back on the basis of ongoing testing that they do in that bay area and if it reaches a certain threshold, they'll basically shut down the fishing that's going on there. And so, I mean, I personally wouldn't trust anything that's being fished out of that that area at all. But but there is fishing that is going on now. That it was an issue that people were paying attention to. I think that issue is more or less, I mean, even to the extent that people were paying attention to it at all, I think that's more or less disappeared from the news these days. And I have not seen in all of this time any difference whatsoever to the amount of people consuming seafood, eating in sushi restaurants, you know, fish that are caught from, you know, who knows where. I haven't seen that affect really consumption at all that I've seen, and I haven't seen any reporting on any, you know, large adverse effect to the fishing industry generally in Japan. So if it is a problem, it's certainly not one that's in the consciousness of most Japanese. And as I say, I think all of the fishing restrictions, as far as I know, have been removed at this point.
Well, that's good news. If there's no restriction on the supply of fish, then presumably the sea life is not being terribly damaged, and reports the contrary are exaggerated.
Well, to the extent that we can trust all of the testing that goes on, which is, I mean, something that we have to keep in mind, because there are obvious economic interests in, you know, and there's been a lot of attempts to promote produce from Fukushima specifically. You know, Fukushima has been hurt by this tragedy, we must support them by buying their produce, whereas, of course, most people want to stay away from Fukushima source produce. So there are the economic incentives that do make that dubious. And so myself and my family, we don't eat anything that's caught in the area. We eat salmon that's caught halfway around the world in Chile and other places, but we won't eat the local seafood.
There were attempts to, or there was a plan that they were going to try to freeze the ground. Put tubes, presumably, that would hold liquid nitrogen into the ground, and it would freeze the ground, and this would prevent the water from leaking out into the ocean. From what I understand, those plans didn't work well, and maybe not at all. And the reason may be that the core of one or more of these nuclear facilities at Fukushima have actually sunk down into the ground. And do people really know where the core is? In other words, it's so deep in the ground that they can't do anything to stop. We're not just dealing with a core that's on the surface of the ground, and we need to make a frozen cordon that's 30 feet deep. We don't need that. We may need something that's 150 feet deep or 200 feet deep. Do we know where the cores are?
No, we do not. We do not have any direct access to the cores. We do not even have any sort of peripheral sensory data to tell us where the cores are lying. And they've started, I remember a year or two ago, there was the story they were going to try to use the cosmic rays of some sort to try to, you know, do a type of X-ray, not X-ray specifically, but a type of X-ray of to find where the cores are lying and all of that. To my knowledge, they still don't really know where the cores are lying. And that's one of the obviously key factors in all of this. They believe it is in the outer containment. They believe it has not penetrated down into the earth and or into the groundwater. But they really don't know at this point. And that is obviously the central problem of the whole thing. And that's what the whole decommissioning process, whatever they're talking about in terms of decommissioning, it really depends on ultimately being able to contain, at the very least, if not actually remove those cores that have melted through the inner containment. As you say, there was the ice wall plan that I believe they kicked off a couple of years ago, but it didn't quite work out. So they went back to the drawing board and turned it on again this year, back in March. But they came out a month later to the plant chief, Yuichi Okamura, came out to say, well, it won't be watertight exactly. I mean, it's not going to be zero water getting through. So they're admitting that it basically doesn't work. It might work to some extent, but certainly not 100%.
Well, I think the other problem is assuming wherever the core is, assuming you could build a wall right now, an ice wall that would contain it, what's to guarantee that the core is going to stay there and it's not going to go even deeper? I mean, your ice wall, this is a live process in the sense that the core may move from place to place and depth go deeper and deeper. And if it does, your previous ice walls may not be adequate.
Concern, Right. The ultimate concern is if and when the core reaches the groundwater and starts to be distributed. That would be a huge concern, because then you have, you know, the most radioactive part being distributed, you know, wherever the groundwater is going, which is obviously a huge, huge issue. So at that point, I think we would be able to detect it. You know, we would be able to detect the change. So
yeah, you can see the, water glowing when it comes out of your tap when you turn it on in the morning to wash your face. Let's take a break for some commercials. I'm here with James Corbett from the Corbett Report, CORBETT report.com. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Condition and emergency rooms and medical doctors are not an option, you need our emergency heart attack kit. 5 concentrated liquid formulas enter the system in 60 seconds to protect your heart muscle, strengthen heartbeat, increase circulation, relieve pain, and make breathing easier. When seconds count, you want all the help you can get with our emergency heart attack kit. Easy to use and portable in a 1-pound compact kit for your purse, briefcase, or car. Call Apothecary Herbs now for your emergency heart attack kit, toll free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at www.thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Okay, I guess we're back. I couldn't hear anything happening, but we are apparently back on the program. The break is over. Uh-huh. And Frank says it's his fault, which it always is. Frank is our producer. His main job is to take responsibility when any sorts of mistakes are made. It's Frank's job to take responsibility, and he's done so in this particular case. So here we are. We're back on. I'm Alfred Addisk. This is Financial Survival, and we're here with James Corbett from the CorbettReport.com, CORBETT. There's been a lot of talk that we are moving to a cashless society. And I'm looking at a graph, a graphic image that was prepared by the Visual Capitalist. And the headline, the title on the graph is "The Shift to a Cashless Society is Snowballing." People are concerned about this. It's, oh, my gosh, we're not going to be able to spend cash. Everything's going to be in plastic. Government's going to be able to track everything we're doing. But the graph itself, the graphic that they provide, indicates to me that the contrary is true. First off, they admit that 85% of transactions globally are done by cash. 85%. About a third of the transactions in Japan and the Asia-Pacific area About a third of those transactions are non-cash, and two-thirds are cash. About two-thirds of the transactions in Europe, Western Europe, are cash. The United States and North America is the only place where we have a majority of transactions are other than cash, credit cards, debit cards, checks, bond, whatever. And even there, it's a 52 to 48% divide. 52% of the transactions are not cash, 48% still are cash. How soon can we change to where we really have 100% cashless society? Is that a possibility, James? And is this something we should be worried about? Or is it distant in our future?
Well, I'm not sure we'll ever get to 100%, because even if all nation states everywhere decided to scrap cash, people would just transact in other types of commodities that would arise in the same way we see in prison economies. Just because they don't have access to money readily doesn't mean that money doesn't arise and people trade in cigarettes or whatever. So, mm-hmm. I mean, the idea of completely eliminating any type of transaction between people other than through some sort of debit card or credit card or whatever is unlikely. But I think we are approaching, you know, we can approach 100%. And I think you're right. It isn't at this point. I mean, we might be at the tipping point in North America, but most of the world is still not quite there. But to put that in perspective, I'm looking at the same infographic that you're looking at, and mm-hmm. they do have the number of cashless transactions worldwide underneath in billions of transactions. Back in 2009, it was 269. By 2014, it's already 389. That's, a 50% increase over the course of 5 years. That's pretty significant. And I think that is a sign of an, if not exponential, at least steadily increasing share of world transactions are becoming non-cash based. And I see that. I don't see anything that would be coming along to disrupt that, that linear growth that we're seeing right now. Because the technology is becoming easier, more affordable, more accessible by more people, as more people at least get online via cell phone technology, which is reaching out to further and further corners of the globe, and more people are at least engaging in banking that way, I think it's going to be more likely in the future that I don't see anything that's putting a brake on this process.
What about hackers? Has the use of cell phones, for example, and plastic cards becomes, we use them more and more, and we go more and deeply into the digital media. Doesn't that also make it easier for the hackers to rob people and make the, you know, your savings, how secure are they if you can get at them with your cell phone?
Yes, 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 of course. And that's exactly why biometric security and other types of new security measures are going to be trotted out and forced down the public's throat one way or another in the coming years. And it is, I mean, to be fair, it is a serious problem. I'm sure most people have either experienced having their card skimmed or credentials stolen in some way, or know someone who has, and it can be nightmarish to have that happen. So it is a real problem, and it does come with the territory. So I think the idea is that, well, we're just going to have two-step authentication, and we're going to have biometric screening and other fancy ways rather than just, you know, password type of security that we've seen in the past.
But do you think we can actually set something up that's digital? You put a digital image of my face associated with transactions. Put a digital image of my thumbprint. A digital image of my DNA, whatever. How hard is it to duplicate that digital image?
There will always be ways around it. For whatever technology you come up with, there will be technology to circumvent that. And to a certain extent, I don't think that's a bad thing from the perspective of the people who at least want more control over this whole process, because there has to be that threat, that uncertainty, in order for increasingly draconian measures to be trotted out as the solution. So if you do want an economy where all transactions have to be scrutinized and processed in some sort of, you know, central, through a central authority, well, that's a good way to do it, is to get people afraid. And you can't have that fear unless there is a genuine threat out there that, you know, your entire life may be stolen from out from under you because you didn't have the proper the proper security on your cell phone or whatever. So I think that threat will always be there, and I think that actually benefits the powers that shouldn't be, as it were.
What about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies in general? Are they increasing that fear, or are they diminishing that fear?
I think the PR narrative that's been put out through the mainstream press, it would be interesting because I do follow the sort of Bitcoin talk and Bitcoin news. So it would be interesting to see it from a fresh set of eyes for people who only ever experience it through the mainstream media. But I would assume that the main impression of Bitcoin is something along the lines of, oh, that's only for, you know, drug transactions or shady business on the internet, or, you know, hackers who steal your stuff and demand ransom in Bitcoin. Those are the types of stories I always see in the mainstream news, along with the occasional story that they found Satoshi Nakamoto, the guy who came up with the Bitcoin idea, or that Bitcoin is going to die any day now. You see those stories pop up every few months. So I think that's the general impression, and I think that does make people wary. Plus, Bitcoin is, I mean, let's not mince words here. It is an off-putting and difficult to understand thing for anyone who's not technical. And that means that pretty much guarantees it's never going to be a widespread form of payment like a PayPal or something that's much more user friendly. So, to a certain extent, that might be good, depending on people's idea of what they want to use Bitcoin for and what transactions they imagine that will be facilitating is to try to, you know, keep it clean, as it were, in terms of keeping the banks and other interests out of the Bitcoin sphere. But we already see them encroaching in on it, and there are moves towards trying to create more type of centralized and easily co-optable forms of Bitcoin or Bitcoin services.
What do you think the chances are that the Federal Reserve, for example, and central banks around the world, if and when the dollar goes down and it dies, what are the chances that they would try to install their own cryptocurrency as an alternative? Is that an improbable, that very unlikely, or is there a chance that might be possible?
I think it's fairly unlikely. I don't think that would be the first line of thinking along there. There's been a lot of interest and scrutiny from central banks, and you've had the Canadian government and other governments commissioning Senate hearings and other things on cryptocurrencies and what they are and you know, how can we use this? Is this something that we can take advantage of? You even had Aurora Coin, I believe it was, that was rolled out, I want to say, in Iceland a few years ago, that almost immediately went under because it just lost its value in about, you know, 2 minutes of trading or something. So it was a failed project, but that was an example of a country trying to roll out its own cryptocurrency. So there has been interest in it, but I just don't think that that's ultimately a cryptocurrency along the blockchain technology type of idea is probably not what central banks want. What they want is something more like a PayPal or something, where it is, again, a centrally processed thing that they can have some sort of access to directly and scan all the transactions that are going on.
Got an article here from Ms. Shedlock. And it says, Saudi Arabia delays payment to contractors, considers IOUs liquidity crunch at best. Saudi Arabia burnt through its reserves faster than anyone thought, in signs of a huge liquidity crunch. The country has delayed paying contractors and now considers paying them with IOUs and tradable bonds. And the implication is Saudi Arabia can't pay its debts right now, or at least it's not willing to pay its debts right now. Is this a big-time story? Is this a little bump in the road? What do you think is happening here?
I think this is a big-time story, and I don't know. I don't know this particular liquidity crisis, whether this is the big sign and the big beginning of the end. But I think it is at the very least indicative of the stories that we're going to start seeing with more frequency in the future. Not just Saudi Arabia, but other oil producers are going to have this type of problem more and more. As I say, not just with the oil crash that we saw in the last couple of years, because that will correct at a certain point, but also just generally speaking, as oil, as the oil transition starts to take place through the Paris Treaty and other agreements that are trying to move the world off oil by hook or by crook, which probably is mostly by crook. So I think this is indicative of a fundamental change that is happening in the markets right now. And I note that William Engdahl had, he's a great researcher. He's written extremely important books on oil geopolitics. He had a recent article about specifically the sort of the end of the Anglo-American oil market as we've known it since at least the end of World War II, as seen in this crisis that we're going through right now. So I think there is an epochal change that's taking place right now. Just don't ask me to predict what it's going to look like on the other side, but I don't think it will look like the order that we've seen over the past few decades of the sort of Saudi-U.S. petrodollar alliance.
That's perhaps the big question. Whether Saudi Arabia goes broke or gets fabulously wealthy maybe isn't the issue. The issue is, what about the petrodollar? That's the dollar's relationship to Saudi Arabian crude oil and crude oil in general. Since the early 1970s, there was a foundation of holding the fiat dollar together. If Saudi Arabia is actually in a financial bind right now, what sort of impact is that likely to have on the dollar's remaining standing as world reserve currency?
Well, this plays into the whole 28 pages thing that's playing out right now that we've seen in the news recently, and the idea that they're going to allow or not allow the 9/11 victims to sue Saudi Arabia. I think that story is perhaps most interesting as a proxy for this geoeconomic warfare that's going on right now. And again, I think it's about this increasingly uneasy alliance between Saudi Arabia and the United States, which, as you say, has been part of the backbone of the dollar system of the past few decades. There's definitely a wedge there, and I don't know if that wedge is necessarily going to sever the relationship altogether, but it is certainly having an effect, and this is part of the long-term reorientation of the world towards the East, China, and Russia, and I think Saudi Arabia is also inching its way towards that alliance, more so than the U.S. one. I guess it's the question of when that breaking point is reached and how it will be reached. I was just going to say, unfortunately, with those types of changes, they generally are preceded or proceeded by warfare.
Well, who are we going to fight in Saudi Arabia? I mean, that's what you're implying. If you're implying that there may be some sort of a scuffle between the United States and Saudi Arabia, how many drones do we need?
Yeah, the bigger picture would be the Russia, Iran, China, maybe Saudi Arabia, maybe if they include themselves in that, and all of their associated entities versus NATO. I think that would be more what we're looking at. Again, it's the sort of bigger picture of what's going on here. Saudi Arabia is just, I think, a proxy for that change that's taking place generally.
All right, James, we are just about out of time. We've got 10, 15 seconds left. Anything you'd like to add?
Not that I can think of, but
where can folks locate you besides the CorbettReport.com? Is that the best place to find you?
It is the best place, but I'm also at, you can read my editorials at theinternationalforecaster.com. Okay. And of course I have FukushimaUpdate.com as well, and a number of affiliated sites, but you can find the links to all of them on CorbettReport.com.
All right, James, thanks very much. Always a pleasure, always interesting. Look forward to talking to you again next week. I'm Alfred Adisk. This is Financial Survival. Melody and I will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank, the producer, James Corbett, and his children and his wife. Good night, folks.
I work all night, I work all day, and pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? There never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. In my dream, I have a plan. If I got me a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work at all. I'd fool around and have a ball. Money, money, money. In a rich man's world, money, 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 always sunny. In a rich